Hello.
Hey, David. Jeffrey Wells.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
I'm quite well. How are you?
Good. Good. Hanging in there.
So, it's funny. I forget how old Anton Yelchin is, but I know that the first time he really sunk in for me was when I saw him in the film, the real life crime film about the guys who killed Alpha Dog.
The Alpha Dog, Nick Cassavetes, yeah.
And that was in 06, that's 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's only, as we speak right now, he's only
18. Yeah. Pretty amazing, huh?
Good looking guy. Good looking, smart, clever, bright guy.
He's a young guy with an old soul.
Yeah. Well,
he is. Not unlike the character he played in their movie. I mean, he really is. He's so bright. Did you ever meet him, Jeff?
I've never met him, actually.
Yeah, he's... I think he's on the launch pad now, so we're very excited for Anton. Yeah, he's done quite a bit of work. I mean, you know, he was always a front runner in terms of our mind for this role.
Yeah.
I mean, naturally, every actor... in town came in, vying, for this part in this movie. But, Anton was always the actor to beat. Because John Pohl also had him, he's really fixated on Anton playing this role. And, just every actor who came in really had to go up against Anton, and nobody came close.
There's a interesting... The heart of the movie is basically this very bright kid from a prep school. He's expelled for selling. I'm not giving away too much for those that haven't seen it, but he's expelled initially for selling illegal driver's licenses, so kids can use it for fake ID.
Right. He's very enterprising.
Yeah. Now that is not. The most venal thing I can imagine a kid can do. As a matter of fact, I don't know of anybody, including the goody-goodies when I was in high school, who wouldn't have quietly winked at the idea of having a decent fake ID so they could go buy beer, so they could have a drink with their girlfriend or something. I mean, every kid does it, so it's not that. So I thought, well, that's just it's unfortunate. It's obviously against the law. It obviously can't be tolerated. But I certainly didn't feel any revulsion at that. That's the coin of the realm.
With Charlie Bartlett, you got to believe that it's probably cumulative, and it's the one thing that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
I mean, you have to ask yourself. the last movie that really impressed me is a movie about. A kid involved in an unfortunate and illegal free enterprise, but at least it shows gumption and organization and all that is Risky Business. Now that was establishing a brothel in his father's home for all these middle class kids. Not that much different. I mean, the films have some similarity. Had that been brought up when you got involved?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you think about the nature of the material, we always have a capacity to reference other movies. So, yeah, Risky Business, Ferris Bueller, Rushmore, Election.
Yeah.
It's a comedy that takes place in that world. It's the world of a teenage boy.
Right.
And, it has a certain irreverence to it, and obviously, the subject matter of the film in itself, and ultimately with, dealing with in the world of prescription medication, it has an edginess to it that films like, for instance, American Pie, is a very different movie,
right.
Less about teens. But, no, those are movies that we've often referenced, so it's not unusual to hear references of Risky Business either.
I've got a 19-year-old and a 17, soon to be 18-year-old.
Uh-huh.
I guess I'm not the involved parent that I could be, but I swear to God, I've never heard of anybody trying to score illegal Ritalin in their circles. But obviously it must be based on some reality. I know that I thought Ritalin was dispensed to kids who were like 10, 11, 12 or younger, something.
No,
like that.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Oh, no, I mean, it just permeates the world. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, there are obviously some very real issues about these medications, you know, and, you know, fortunately, you know, the film is not black and white, you know, in terms of, you know, are these medications good? Are they bad? It's not that simple.
Yeah.
In the case of Charlie Bartlett, it doesn't go to that place to debate the issue of whether they're good or bad. But it is prevalent. It's very prevalent. It's interesting with your kids. I mean, because you know, I know my nieces. You know, are seem to be very acutely aware of it, and they're in high school as well.
Is it kind of a speed buzzy thing, David? What is kind of a jazzy kind of a methadrine, benzedrine thing? What is it like? I have no idea what the high is. Is it like coke or something? What does it feel like?
Well, I can't speak from first hand experiences, but from what
it makes
I
two of us.
So you know, it's like an element of speed, you know.
Okay.
So that's the effect, you know.
So it cranks you up and
it cranks you up. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I don't know where I got the idea that it was something more subtle than that.
Did your kids, Jeff? Did you talk to them about it? They said that they weren't aware that like prescription medication is kind of a.
I know that my younger son got hold of something about a year and a half ago, but it wasn't Ritalin.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's not isolated to just Ritalin. I think there's a variety of these medications, and you know, seemingly they have a very similar effect. You know, when not taken properly.
Yeah. In any case, I don't want to get off on a track.
Of course not. No.
But the thing was that what does everybody want? Everybody wants to be. Listened to,
yes.
You know, loved, cared for. They want to feel that they somehow fit in some kind of social group, and that you know, they're not just you know, ephemera, and that they're, you know, they matter. Their life has value.
Exactly.
And this kid who's basically he has a gift for. The heart of it is when he starts doing his analysis sessions.
Right.
Again, I'm not giving too much, but he does them in a bathroom.
Right. Well, that's his confessional.
He has a confessional, right? Yeah.
You know, that's where his office. The doctor is in.
Yeah.
And but that the thematic of it is very true. What you just touched on, which is ultimately, you know, it's about kids being listened to.
Yeah.
And somebody who takes the initiative to do that. You know, and not somebody necessarily is highly trained, but well-intentioned.
Right, right. So, you know, I got to say, though, there is a film that talk about references. I mean, there it ends, and I think this is, you have to address this. The Charlie Bartlett ends with a person speaking to, I forget, is it a cop or who is it? Some older guy. And he's asking, and Charlie says, "Do you want to talk about it?" In other words, he senses that the guy wants to talk to Charlie. That's the same, exact same dead ending as Lawrence Kasdan's Mumford, which is about a guy who's impersonates a therapist, but it turns out he has a gift for it. Or rather, people just naturally want to tell him their problems, their hang-ups, their troubles. Some people are like that. They just have that and that's what Charlie Bartlett is.
Well, when he, and I don't want to give too much of the film away, you know, talking about the end, you know, how the movie ends, but it does tie in with the theme of the movie, which is a kid who is a listener, and he harkens back to the reference when, you know, Robert Downey has an encounter with him earlier on in the film, and he kind of is eliciting Robert Downey, the principal of the school, who's at the time concerned because of the boy's, you know, overdose, and you know, he basically gets Robert in that scene, if you recall, you know, is you want to talk about it, you know, he starts kind of getting Robert to open up to him, which you know, obviously frustrates the principal of the school because his intention wasn't to have Charlie assess, you know, his you know, his issues.
Yeah.
Anyway, so but that is really what the thematic, what the movie is about, and I think it treats it in a kind of a fun, enlightening way, and it harkens back to some of the movies we talked about. I think, although I think it's truly an original.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the it's funny, but Downey, he looks like he's in great shape. I mean,
he's in great shape. It's very exciting, you know, for him where he's at in his career right now. I mean, he's firing obviously on all cylinders. He was wonderful in the film. We were blessed that he responded to the picture when we brought him the project, and you know, the irony, of course, is Robert would have played this role probably himself, this is Charlie Bartlett role, that is, you know, 20 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, all the materials I've seen on Iron Man and everything I've heard about the film, you know, obviously that's on the launch pad, and Thunder Road, my God, I you know, I'm just very anxious to see the movie. Very clever, very original script.
I don't know anything about Thunder Road. Is that that's the thing he shot after Iron Man?
Yes, the Stillers film that Ben's directing, comedy.
Oh, no, that's called Tropic Thunder, isn't it?
Tropic Thunder. Yeah, what did I say?
Robert Mitchum film called Thunder Road.
Oh, Thunder Road. Jeez. Okay. Yeah, no, Tropic Thunder. No, no, no. It wasn't a remake of Robert Mitchum's film. I remember that movie. But then he's shooting now with Joe Wright, you know, which is an exciting project opposite Jamie Foxx. So anyway, so his life is he's got a pretty full dance card.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were very lucky to get Robert on in this picture. He brings a weight and a gravitas to that role, and he's listen, he's a great actor. He's one of our greatest actors ever.
Yeah. Did he make your film right after Zodiac or right before Zodiac? What was the sequence?
It was after Zodiac.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, can you just give me a little history of how you got together with the director, John Paul, who's done a lot, whose history is mainly in editing. He cut some of the more, you know, like Meet the Fockers and Death to Smoochie and
Austin
Parents.
Powers, and he produced 40-Year-Old Virgin, so he's worn many hats in the business, you know, and...
So he's an Apatow friend, is it? I mean, Judd Apatow and he, are they in league also?
No, yes, I think he's friends of Judd, yes, and he's also a colleague and a very good friend of Jay Roach's. Here's a brief history. I'll try to give it to you in a shorthand because the long, windy road of films getting made, as you well know.
Yeah.
What happened was years ago, and I'm talking... maybe, geez, 3-4 years ago, I acquired a book called Youth in Revolt, which is somewhat of a landmark book amongst teens. It's kind of their catcher in the rye, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a coming-of-age story about a young boy, a teenager who lives with a white trailer trash type family, and he's an intellectual of sorts, and he is at a quest to lose his virginity. And the book is, you know, a highly acclaimed book. It's like a cottage industry on the internet. It's called Youth in Revolt. C.D. Payne wrote it.
Right.
And I announced that I had acquired it, and I was inundated, quite honestly, with rather seasoned writers, A-level writers, you know, vying for the opportunity to adapt this 500-page book.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a challenge because of the length and the density of the book, and there's so many great things in there. To try to distill that into a script was a challenging effort. There was a young kid, a 28-year-old kid at the time, who was selling cameras at Ritz Cameras in the Valley in a mall in Burbank,
mm-hmm.
who wrote a script and got it to me with the hopes and expectations of maybe getting a shot to direct the book that he loved, Youth in Revolt. Because
right.
he knew I owned it because we had announced acquiring it, and he read that somewhere. Anyway, my development chief, who has worked with me many years, calls me in the middle of the night and says, you got to read this script that came in as a writing sample from this guy who wants to adapt Youth in Revolt, even though we were talking to some pretty prominent writers. And this kid had no produced credits. He was just a kid who wrote a script on spec, hoping to get my attention with this as a writing sample. In any event, I fell in love with this writing sample script, and he was in my office literally the next day. I'd read it that night. Steve Longi sent it to my home, and I read it, and it spoke to the voice of potentially Youth in Revolt, which is also about in the teenage world. Anyway. His name is Gustin Nash, and he came to my office the next day. I said, look, number one, I will certainly convince the studio that you're the writer to adapt Youth in Revolt. There was no doubt in my mind I said, and by the way, this piece of material that you sent as your writing sample, I want to make this movie. And the writing sample, of course, was Charlie Bartlett.
Ah, right.
And that's how Gustin Nash came into our lives.
Mm.
So,
how old is he,
Gustin
Nash?
So I guess he's 29, 30 years old now.
Okay.
Maybe 29.
Right.
29.
So Ruth, Youth and Revolt got made or is being made? Or what's
I'm
going
in pre-production with Youth and Revolt. Michael Cera is starring in Youth and Revolt. We start production in April, and Miguel Arteta is signed to direct as of last week.
He's the guy who did Star Maps, right?
Yes, and Chuck and Buck and The Good Girl with Jennifer Aniston and Jake Gyllenhaal,
right,
who I've been chasing since Star Maps because I think he's enormously talented. Anyway, and a perfect fit for Youth and Revolt, ultimately. Well, anyway, the long and short of it, Jeff, is he successfully, obviously, adapted Youth and Revolt, and we're making that movie with Gustin's wonderful adaptation. And Charlie Bartlett, on the other hand, at the time, I went to Jay Roach to direct Charlie Bartlett, and Jay fell in love with the script, and Jay was on board at the time to direct. Ultimately, Jay, you know, we developed it. You know, we actually made some changes in the script, so we went through a pass on the script, if you will. And then Jay was going to go off, and he had another movie at Fox that at the time he was going to make. And then I started meeting other directors. So I met a lot of other seasoned directors with a very strong script that attracted a lot of interest. And then Jay called me and suggested that I meet with his editor in Austin Powers and meet the parents, world-class editor, you know, John Pohl, whose name I knew, but I never met John. And he had just produced 40-Year-Old Virgin. And so John came into my office, and, you know, what was probably going to be a half-hour meeting evolved into a two-and-a-half-hour meeting. And, you know, it's like you know when you're sitting across from somebody who talks so articulately about the material and the balance of the humor with the weight of what this movie is about, you know, dealing with some serious subject matters, which it does. And the tone of the movie was always a concern, finding the right filmmaker with the balance of that tone. And anyway, John talked about the movie in every detail.
Yes, I want to know, can I just hold 1 second and I'll tell somebody, I'll call them right back. Hello? 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 Sorry, David, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It really blew every other director who had been vying to direct this movie out of the water, and that's how John Pohl came into our life, and we were fortunate that that happened. And John delivered a movie that I am enormously proud of, and I love the film. Fortunately, other people do too. So I'm delighted with that. But that's the brief history of the evolution of the project. So it's kind of, went through a long, windy road like many projects.
Yeah.
But, and that was over, I guess, 3-4 years or something, which in our business, I think somebody told me one time the average development process for movies that get made is usually about 7 years. I said, well, we're under 7 years, that if that's true. But anyway,
my Syracuse son, the one that was a sophomore at Syracuse, read Youth and Revolt last year, and he was very keen on it.
I'm glad to hear that.
And then I happened to get hold of the script. And
did he read the script?
He didn't want to read it.
Oh, no kidding. Does he want to see the movie?
I just want the movie to happen. I don't want to read the script. He said,
good. Well, I want the movie to happen, too. Unfortunately, now it is happening. It actually, you know, also took a long, kind of windy road, but it's found its rightful home with the Weinsteins, with Bob Weinstein and Dimension.
Oh, great.
And they're bankrolling the picture, and we're on our way. And the other thing about that, interestingly enough, is Michael Cera. You know, we started talking to Michael long before, Superbad, or certainly Juno, so before he's become such an amazing screen presence in the world today with his huge successes.
Yeah.
So we got lucky, you know, very lucky, because, as you know, casting is so key. I mean, Charlie Bartlett, the name of our movie, is it so revolves around the actor who's this film is, you know, lives on his shoulders. I mean, there's so many aspects of the film I can talk about in glowing terms, and in terms of the other actors, the balance of, you know, what Robert brings to the role, what Hope Davis brought to the role, and that wonderful the movie. I mean, Tyler Hilton played Elvis Presley in Walk the Line, an accomplished musician. He came in and auditioned for the role with a mohawk, like in wardrobe, and he blew every other actor that we met right out of the water. Kat Dennings, who was in 40-Year-Old Virgin, you know, the right balance she brought to the movie as his girlfriend. But nevertheless, you listen, Anton, the movie revolves very much around Anton and his life and his world. So we got lucky with the casting on that, and I think we potentially also got lucky, naturally, with Michael Cera now on board with Youth and Revolt.
Yeah. So. By the way, I was just checking on Youth and Revolt. And it says on the not always dependable IMDb that it's the plan is to have it out by the end of the year. That's kind of fast, no?
It's not going to be out by the end of the year.
All right.
It'll be out next year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Although you should, we should all keep in mind that it used to be. You know, when I always tell people the story, but Anatomy of a Murder, the according to the DVD jacket.
Yeah.
Was shot in the spring, I'm talking March, April, of 1959.
Yeah.
It was in theaters in July. That's what it says.
It was very fast. You know, I think the record for that is me.
Yeah?
We shot a movie in 1975 on videotape in one night.
Uh-huh.
It was released theatrically 3 weeks later. The actor got an Academy Award nomination for a movie made on video, transferred to film, and it looked like shit, but the actor was brilliant. And he got an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor in 1975. It cost $135,000 to film in one night on video.
And you're going to tell me the title, of course.
James Whitmore, Give Him Hell, Harry. He was doing Harry Truman in a one-man show.
Absolutely. That was a great show. Sure, that was
he got lucky. We had six cameras.
Yeah.
Watch him be brilliant on stage.
Right.
So I got the record, not Otto Preminger. And then I won the record again.
Right.
1979. Two nights. Not one, two.
Yeah.
Tape to film, looked like shit, terrible quality back then. Technically, the quality, you know, isn't what it is today. So tape to film.
Yeah.
In release 3.5 weeks after it was shot in Long Beach, the Long Beach Terrace Theater, Richard Pryor live in concert.
That was the most brilliant concert
every studio
of all time.
Down. It was in the can. Everybody turned it down for distribution. Nobody's going to come to see a concert movie. Nobody's going to see Richard Pryor. You know, this black comic is going to do maybe some business in you know, a couple of major cities, but that's it. And the picture went out. We released it ourselves. The picture did $32.5 million on a budget of nothing.
You released you four-walled it?
No. We made deals with Salah Hassanin, who was chairman of UA Theater, Sumner Redstone.
Oh, okay.
We made deals with the theaters.
Right.
So, anyway, it's that's a long story, but...
That's astonishing that every single person... You think there'd be one, you know, kind of nervy Weinstein-like distributor at the time who would have said this could work.
I was nothing. They didn't think twice. They didn't want to see the film. I literally brought the canisters around to the screenings in those days, and it was hard to get the studios to even look at what was considered just there's no audience for a concert movie. It's a comic on stage. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, and you didn't have HBO and what have you back then. 1979 was Richard Pryor's concert film.
Right.
So, you know, it's interesting now with Hannah Montana. You know, I'm going to go back to my roots, I think, and start filming some other concerts and events, maybe. I don't know. The economics of it, obviously, is a whole other world. It costs nothing.
How many cameras were used on the Richard
Pryor? Six.
Okay. Because that was pretty well covered. I like the way that...
Yeah.
It did not feel like it was...
Yeah. You know, directed it? The guy who directs the Academy Awards every year, Jeffrey Margolis.
Okay. Huh.
You know, video director. You know, directed Give Mel Harry, Steve Bender, who directed a lot of the TV specials, including the Elvis Presley specials.
Huh.
You know, it's like television, live television. You got six cameras.
Right.
You know, my job was to basically pay people to go out and have steak dinners because there were cameras in their seats that they had not intended to because it was a live theater show.
Yeah.
We just had the right to have six cameras, watch Richard be brilliant, and watch James Whitmore be brilliant in 1975. So that whole concept to me is really very much coming back, and it's in the air. I mean, the Hannah Montana, you know, with an over $30 million grossing film blowing out every other movie, you know, last weekend, you know, Actually, the show that I really wanted to do many years ago, Jeff, and I made an offer on it, but I couldn't go up against Universal, and they blew it because the movie was horrific, was Chorus Line. Chorus Line should have been shot in front of a live audience with the immediate and spontaneity of a live audience, and they released as an event, and it really would have connected with audiences. You know, when we did Give 'Em Hell, Harry, American Express, and I don't know if you remember this, I had talking years ago, yeah. after we hit that movie and got an Oscar nomination for a movie made in one night on video with James Whitmore, American Express invested $50 million in the movie business. And what they wanted to do was bring theater to movie audiences. And they filmed Rhinoceros, and they filmed all these classics. And they did it in the sterility of sound stages, and they lost their shirt. So it's the only time American Express has ever ventured into the movie business back then. But the concept was an interesting one that worked for us, and in fact can work again under the right circumstances with the right type of show, especially with event movies today and the 3D process, you know, with Hannah Montana and the U2 movie, which I don't know if you've seen yet.
I saw it in Cannes.
Yeah, I saw it in Sundance. And, you know, I tell you something, it's very interesting what's going on in the business now, and it kind of takes me back to my, you know, early, very fortunate career with the early success I had with those movies anyway.
Yeah.
I digress here, and I'm sorry, but it is interesting, you know, thinking about, you know, the world today that in terms of those type of movies.
Has that been decently... you know, I was just thinking, I would have been much more interested in seeing A Chorus Line, as you describe it, than to see Richard Attenborough's take on it.
No, they tried to open it up, and they tried to get into the backstories of all. You know what? It was pure theater. It was a spontaneity and immediacy.
Yeah.
And if it had shot, you know, listen, it's always easy to look back in hindsight when something doesn't work. But in fact, Chorus Line was really, and we kept coming back with offers. So we were in the game many years ago when we were bidding on that. But Universal just, you know, won out on that one. But, there are a number of shows like that. They come along every once in a while, and I've kind of always got my eye on them. So, you know, I'm going to be probably going back to my roots very shortly when I find the right type of vehicle to do it with.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right,
I'm happy about Bartlett. I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad your son is looking forward to seeing the movie of Youth and Revolt.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell him he doesn't need to read the script. He'll see the movie next year, not this year.
All right.
And anything you can do to help us on Bartlett is appreciated. You know, it's, you know, the movie, a movie like this, you know, on the marketplace. Look, I hope we follow in the path that Juno has made, I think, for us in a way. You know, they deal with teen pregnancy in their movie, a real issue. I think we deal with prescription medication in ours. So there are some similar themes going on in these movies, and a number of the critics have reviewed the films, referenced Juno. So I'm happy with that because I love Juno, obviously, and a lot of other people did too, evidently.
Yeah. Except I don't. It doesn't sound sexy to me to say prescription. It sounds sexy to talk about free enterprise and going into business for yourself, and because basically this is a guy who's is making his own moves, and he's unfortunately afoul of prescribed law, but you like a guy like that.
I like him. He's very endearing. He's a very endearing character in the movie, and the way Anton naturally portrayed him that way, and he ultimately takes responsibilities, you know, for his actions.
Right.
And it's a responsible movie. At the same time, I think it's an enormously entertaining film, and I think the audiences have, you know, really responded to it. I mean, every time we screen the movie, every preview, I mean, and you hear producers often say this, you know, oh, the numbers are through the roof. And, you know, with this movie, it actually was the case. The audiences consistently have really embraced the film. You know, it's an endearing character that you root for. And it's fresh and original, and has a vibrancy to it. So I'm very hopeful for it to go out there, and looking forward to it. So,
good talking to you, man. And you've just made me decide I'm going to go find the Richard Pryor concert film on DVD. I guess
you're going to love it. The name of the company, you'll see, our guy, we named it C, Special Event Entertainment.
Okay.
And we did that because the goal was to do other events,
right.
You know, and maybe it's time to reactivate that company.
Yeah.
And you're going to love, I mean, yeah. Listen, Richard was brilliant. We were just the lucky guys on two nights to capture his brilliance. And he years turned me down. He didn't want to do it for many, many years.
Is the DVD of that concert film indecent? Does it look good?
Yes. Well, you know what? You don't give a shit how it looks. You know, that's the reality of it. You know, it looks, yeah, it looks good because we did everything we could to make it look good.
Right.
But it's still, it's 1979, tape to film quality.
Right.
But you know what? You overlook, forgive everything because you can't stop laughing.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I didn't realize that was shot on tape and then transferred.
Yes, it was, as was Give 'Em Hell, Harry.
Okay.
You know, that's the irony. I mean, Give 'Em Hell, Harry, that Oscar nomination for a movie made on videotape in one night, released 3 weeks later by us, by ourselves,
yeah.
At a total cost of like a little over $100,000.
Okay.
The picture did $11 million, mm. Give 'Em Hell, Harry.
Yeah.
After the Oscar nomination, you know, the theaters started wanting to print.
Right.
So, anyway, it was a pretty phenomenal thing to be involved with those two films. But, yeah, go back and revisit Pryor. You won't disappoint you.
Okay.
All right, Jeff.
Nice speaking to you.
Thanks.